All right, welcome to Pop Ranks. I am your co-host, Eric Wickstrom.
And your other co-host, Scott Carroll.
And today we're going to talk about a couple of things. First of all, we're going to talk about physical media, which is a...
which is slowly dying.
Which is a thing Scott is very committed to and loves, and we're going to get into that for a second. And then we're going to give you, not so much a ranking so much this time, but a list of 10 titles from Criterion that Scott thinks are worth checking out based on the films themselves and the bonus features that Criterion does. So let's talk about physical media.
Physical media.
Have a collection of a couple DVDs?
At this point, I've probably got about 8,000 DVDs.
8,000. Now,
I mean, I've been collecting them since the format came out. But to give you a little background, I've been collecting physical media of movies probably my whole life. Right. I started with little Super 8 films that you'd get, you know, you'd buy like a little 5-minute clip of a movie. I had Star Wars, which was a big deal. I had 12 minutes worth of Star Wars on a Super 8 film. Then I bumped up. I got a sound projector, so I would do that. Then eventually that led to VHS. You know, obviously the VHS boom was huge and everyone was recording everything left, right, and center. So I had a big VHS collection, including purchasing VHSs, which were very expensive when they first came out. That led to Laserdiscs, DVD, Blu-ray, and presently 4K Blu-rays.
So would you say 8,000, is that 8,000 pieces of physical media, or is that just DVDs?
DVDs. So, and Blu-rays 4K, but that's the DVD discs.
Discs. You have 8,000 discs.
Yeah.
Now, do you still have VHS?
I still have some VHSs laying around my house.
Laserdiscs?
Which one?
You have Laserdiscs laying around?
I still have Laserdiscs. There are some Laserdiscs I've kept for sentimental reasons. A lot of nice additions they put out. I have an Evil Dead 2 Laserdisc because the disc itself is red,
okay,
which is nice. I've got the original Star Wars trilogy in its original form on Laserdisc, unaltered original theatrical versions, which you cannot get on Blu-ray. They did do a very low-grade DVD release because they really don't want to release them. So they, to a piece of fans, they said, okay, fine, here's a, which I think was just a VHS transfer onto disc, which nobody was happy with. But I do have those original three.
So if you want to see Han shoot first, you come to Scott's basement.
Yep, you go to, pop on my list, just Han shoot first. Although I did Hush Hush buy the despecialized Blu-ray special edition at a convention, but that's not an official release.
So you still have all that. You don't have any Super 8s anymore, right?
No. Those went the way of the garage sale. I mean, there was no reason to keep them at all. So
all told, we've got, 8,500, 9,000 pieces of physical media in your house?
Yeah, probably everything under the sun. Yeah.
Okay, so now...
I actually got profiled in a magazine for that collection.
This is true. What magazine was that?
It was a magazine called Media Play News. They're an online publication, but they do have a print version, and they were... I caught an article one time online through another website where they were soliciting for people with large physical media collections.
The article's still online, though, right? We can link to it.
Yeah,
so we'll link to it in the description here.
They were looking for people that had big physical media collections, so I wrote them in. Unfortunately, the guy called me back. I wasn't home to take his phone call, so I called him back, left a message. He never called me back. They when they were asking about the physical media, they asked for just a quick questionnaire of some questions about what you had, and I answered that and didn't hear back from the guy. Didn't think anything of it. All of a sudden, the magazine came out, and there I was. Some of my quotes from the questionnaire in black and white in the article, mostly talking about of how many times I have bought Star Wars.
Yeah, well, that's like people buying, you know, Michael Jackson's Thriller or the Eagles' Greatest Hits on, you know, for albums, because they keep coming on every different format.
Yeah.
So, like, we talk about the Eagles selling, you know, it's one of the best-selling albums of all time, Eagles' Greatest Hits. Well, yeah, it came out on vinyl, then it went to A-Track, and then it went to CD.
Same thing.
And then it just went to every cassette tape and every other thing in between. Everybody kept rebuying it, and that's why everybody bought 6 to 8 copies of it. Same thing with Star Wars. So I stopped buying Star Wars years ago myself. But so for that very reason, it was enough. So you still, to this day, so now all this stuff, people think, okay, so I think the argument is that all this stuff is available for streaming. What is the point of owning 8,500 pieces of physical media? But that's probably not true, right?
That's probably not true. There is a lot of things that are still not available on streaming services. To digress a little bit, and also there are so many streaming services. Every movie studio and company now, they want to package their own content and have their own site and their own streaming service, which you have to pay $10 a month for, or $20 or $7 or whatever. So, you know, if you kind of have like a wide range of tastes like I do, and you like comedies and horror films and documentaries and dramas, in order to have access to all those things, you have to subscribe to all right. these services. And a lot of the services are geared more towards their original content. So for me, my entire life, I always wanted to have a film collection
right.
at my fingertips. Like people have book collections, stamp collections. I always wanted a movie collection.
Now, how much of this, like when you're home, like how much do you think you actually watch a year though?
Well, I mean, I probably watch something every night. I probably watch at least one movie a day.
Really?
I mean,
every day, even now, you pull something off the shelf and throw it in and watch it?
Yeah, I mean, I have a long commute home via, I commute by a commuter train, so right. I have a DVD, a physical DVD player, portable, that I bring with me, so I usually watch either if I'm invested in a TV series of some sort, which I am buying on sometimes on physical media, I'll either watch an episode of a show or I'll pick a movie. It's got to be like 90 minutes or less so I can watch the whole thing.
But when you're not commuting, when you're home at night or on the weekends, are you pulling stuff off the shelf to watch?
Sometimes I'll go back and revisit something, like if there's a sequel coming out to something, I'm like, oh, I haven't seen the original. I want to refresh my memory in case there's any Easter eggs or inside jokes. So I'll go back and I'll watch an original. If it's something a family or a friend member hasn't seen, I might pull it off a shelf. You know, my son, college age right now, so we're revisiting films that I've loved.
Right.
He's of a different generation, so a lot of the things I'm showing him, he doesn't quite have the appreciation for it like I do.
Right.
Because it's of its time.
But what about, where are you getting this stuff? Because at this point,
it's getting more difficult.
I mean, just this DVDs, week, right? Best Buy said they're not going to stock
they
anymore.
Pulling it off the shelves. DVDs. I mean, when DVDs came out, you could pretty much buy them everywhere.
Of course, they were
you could buy them in the supermarket. You know, your Best Buys, your Target, your HMV record stores, your Virgin Records. I mean, same thing with LaserDiscs.
Yeah.
Maybe not LaserDiscs, but you could buy these things all over the place.
Right.
Then as time went on, you know, a lot of like chain stores started kind of reducing their footprint, so to speak, in physical media. So it became, you know, a little harder to get things. Best Buy was always a big source for me because they'd always put their new releases out.
So where do you go now for it?
Now it's primarily Amazon. So, online. You know, like I said, I go to websites and I keep track of what's coming out when. I'm like, oh, I like that movie. I either want to see it because I missed it in theaters
right.
or it's something I want to own because it's something I enjoyed.
So now the argument against physical media, A, streaming, but B, like a lot of people want to complain, it's wasteful, the plastic, the environmental impact, all that stuff.
Yeah,
so
you do need to have a room for your physical media. Right. My room has long since now become overstuffed. I have things piled up on the floor now because all my shelves are filled.
Right.
For a time, I had everything alphabetized, but now I think I need an entire other room
right.
to keep track of it. So, you know, when my son says, oh, I want to watch... you know, we want to watch Home Alone. Sometimes it takes a little bit of an archaeological dig
right.
to find out where that disc is. But for the most part, like I said, I always wanted to have a collection. For me, that was always important. And what I always loved growing up, and I'm starting to miss now because physical media is going away, one of my favorite things to do on the weekend would be to go into a record store and just browse. Go into a listening station. Do I want to listen to this album? Maybe when I walked in,
they'd
be playing a record, and I'd go, oh, what's that? Who's that artist? I like that song.
Yeah, well, that's what I, you know, again, I'm a little younger than you, but I remember that very much growing up, going to record stores and hanging out for like an hour. And I, that's, you know, naively, I always thought, you know, video stores are never going to go away, and record stores are never going to go away because people like that. People like browsing. People like that interaction, but turned out I was wrong. People don't really care too much about it, especially this newer generation. So the argument against physical media, it's the plastic, it's the manufacturing, it's the environmental impact, not only creating the media, but then dumping it into landfills, right? So I guess to play devil's advocate, why keep collecting at this point if it's going the way of the dinosaur?
Well, for me, I mean, you notice on a lot of streaming services, they'll make a license with a studio for a certain number of films. They might keep them for a little while, but then they'll dump them.
Right.
You know, there was a time I don't want to name streaming services specifically, but you couldn't see Titanic. You know, at the time, the most popular movie ever made.
Right.
And you couldn't see it streaming. Whereas I just go over to my shelf, look under T. I do have that one alphabetized. Yeah. Oh, I want to watch Titanic. So I could do that. But there's, like I said, there's a lot of old movies. I mean, Abbott and Costello stuff, you know, James Dean movies. I mean, a lot of them you can see on Amazon Prime. But, you know, for me as a collector, you know, like I said, I've pretty much got a history of Hollywood at my fingertips.
Right.
Now, again, it does take a lot of discipline to, you know, to keep track of it and buy it. And, it, you know, obviously it costs money to buy these discs and maintain them. But to me, I'll always have access to them. Right. I will always have that collection. I used to love going over people's houses and thumbing through their record collection where right. they're, oh, wow, you bought The Empire Strikes Back. Oh, I love that movie. You know, have you seen it? You know, or whatever, you know, The Shawshank Redemption or whatever. You know, and I feel that's kind of going away.
Right.
And it was always fun to kind
so
of
So really, it's
notes.
More nostalgia for you than anything.
Very much so.
Renting a movie for streaming, fine. Like, I had to rent a movie recently. I went to Amazon. I paid the $4 and I watched the movie. Fine.
Yeah.
People that buy streamed versions, people that buy a movie for $20 to own as a...
Which they don't really own.
Right, it just
sits in
the cloud.
You're buying a license to watch that movie, and at some point, that license can be taken away.
Right, you don't physically
own
that.
Or they may dump the movie from the site. And then,
right.
You know,
video games is the one that always drives me crazy, because you buy a video game download,
yeah,
but then you can't do anything with that. You can't transfer that download to somebody for money. Like, you can sell... No, I guess so. You're not really. You're never really looking to sell any of this collection, right? You're taking it with you, so to speak.
It's going to go with me. I mean, I've spoken to my son about it, and hopefully, when I move on, I hope he. I don't expect him to continue it the way I have,
right?
But I hope he'll keep the collection because it is, like I said, it is a unique history of Hollywood
right.
because I've got all kinds of films, directors, times, genres. And it's like I said, it's
what is
really,
what is your wife saying at this point about the collection?
I think she's given up criticizing me over it. It's you know, it's always, movies have always been part of my life. It's what I love. I love
right.
I love hearing stories. I love watching movies and being transported to different places. And, you know, I have memories of who I saw these films with, when, and which friends, which family members. I remember going to see this opening night or, you know, getting together and doing that. So, you know, a lot of me revisiting these movies is revisiting that memory, you know. So maybe for me, having that physical copy of it for
right.
me is kind of a, you know, holding on to a memory of when I had it. But again, like I said, I can watch something whenever I want it. It's at my fingertips. A lot of times the physical media presentation is a lot better than
right.
the streaming presentation. You don't have to worry about your router going down or there being interruptions in the internet service where things are going to skip.
Right.
I have a lot of problems with that these days where the processing speed isn't enough, so things will skip or jump.
So you're looking for uninterrupted nostalgia.
Yeah. I like behind-the-scenes stuff. I like watching documentaries.
So you deep dive on special features.
Into things I like. I listen to commentary tracks, interviews, archival stuff. And to me, that's going to be, with streaming, that's something that's going to be lost in streaming because
right.
they're not going to host.
So what do you think?
Stuff.
I mean, because it's definitely gone down a lot the last few years. So what
yeah.
do you, I mean, how much longer do you anticipate actually being able to purchase physical copies of things, new things?
Well, the interesting thing is, like I said, like Best Buy just got rid of them. Target got rid of them. Amazon, you can still buy things. There's a lot of boutique labels that have cropped up in,
right.
in the years.
But like at what point does like the new Mission Impossible not go to DVD?
I haven't seen that happen yet. Although there are some streaming things that are being made for streaming originals that you like the movie Coda, which won Best
yes.
Picture. 2 years ago, you can't get a physical copy of that.
Right.
You have to stream it. I mean, I'm very much looking forward to seeing, I haven't seen yet Killers of the Flower Moon, the Scorsese movie. They
right.
haven't done a physical release of that yet. Will they? I have no idea. I'm hoping they do. I've got all of Scorsese's other movies.
Right.
But
so you're a completist too. So like if no matter how terrible that entry is.
Yeah, I like to have the set. I've got all the Highlander films, as atrocious as part two and part five. To me, it's part of the
right.
series.
So you have all of it.
Yep. We'll have to do that ranking at some point of the Highlander films.
I'll have to bring a special guest in for that because there's no way I'm sitting through all of those to get the knowledge to even attempt it. So, all right. Yeah. I mean, again, I definitely think it's interesting. You're definitely not alone in these pursuits. There's a lot of people that are into physical media are very committed to physical media. It's very much, you know, and I find that a lot of people would probably listen to this and go, oh, DVDs or Blu-rays, why would I buy? And they probably have a vinyl collection that they're spending $40 on a Led Zeppelin album for,
right.
like at Barnes and Nobles or something. I see that. I see, you know, albums on for sale for $30, $50 a copy for an album. People are buying them. People are insane. It doesn't sound that much better.
You know, it was a very difficult physical to release to buy this past Christmas season?
What's that?
Oppenheimer.
Really?
Everybody, there was a shortage of Oppenheimer. There was a big calling because people wanted to buy Oppenheimer.
Well, having seen Oppenheimer, there's nothing short about it. It was very long, very good, but
I pre-ordered mine. I've got it.
Let me just say I shouldn't have gotten the extra large drink when I went in because I had to pee real bad the last hour of that movie. So on the topic of physical media, one of the companies that I do think is still doing really interesting stuff and I could justify, because I don't buy physical media, but I certainly could understand and defend people's wanting to buy releases from the Criterion Collection. Criterion's been around a long time. I'm not sure when they started. My first remembrance of them is on Laserdisc.
Yeah, yeah.
I was in film school back in the you know, mid-90s, and I was studying Scorsese, and I was studying Spielberg and Coppola and all the filmmakers of that time, and Tarantino was coming out. So Criterion was doing special editions, and I remember those commentary tracks and getting to listen to Scorsese talk about, especially Raging Bull, and I remember that one very clearly, and Taxi Driver, and having him deep dive the commentary tracks while you're in film. It was invaluable as a film student to hear. It was like sitting with Martin Scorsese and listening to that. So Criterion's always had this history of doing these amazing releases with these really interesting, high-quality commentary tracks and special features.
Yeah, so, it's really for film lovers. They select not only important, what they deem as important films, socially relevant films, but they also dive into, you know, pop culture. I mean, you can get a Criterion edition of Michael Bay's Armageddon.
Right.
Now, is that some movie that's big,
changed
huge
when I first became aware of Criterion back in the 90s, they were very snobby. They were very bougie and very nose up, I think. They did all about art films and culture. Like, it had to be art. You weren't going to get Armageddon back in the 90s. Right. I think they've loosened it up probably because, again, physical media is dying, so they need to attract as many people as possible to buy their product to keep in business. So I think you're seeing a lot more, let's say, lesser films in terms of critical darlings coming onto Criterion in the last 10 years or so than you would before that, the decade before, but still doing amazing work. So I guess quickly, if you run through them, it's impossible to rank Criterion releases. There are now, hundreds and hundreds of them.
I mean, they do special compilations of all kinds of directors. You can get things of Jean-Luc Godard and Akira Kurosawa and, you know, silent films, old films. So they're kind of opening their birth a little bit, but they're, like I said, if you want to do it, as Eric said, like a deep dive in a particular film, they really do put a nice package together.
Yeah. What I asked Scott to do was to go into his collection, as we discussed. It's a very varied and deep collection. And
I don't have all the Criterion collection. No. But these are just ones that are,
and
have
pull out
my eye.
10, and I'm even ranking them, just 10 titles he thinks are worth checking out. For whatever reason.
Yeah, so either historical reason or by nature of the packaging itself. So the first one I picked out, very influential film for me, is Akira Kurosawa's The Seven Samurai.
Which I've seen on Criterion.
Which is on Criterion. They did a restored edition of the film, like an extended cut. But, I mean, this is one of the most influential action movies ever made.
It is. It is. Again, I'd be curious if people today coming to it, especially young people, would
probably find it a little slow.
Really slow. Yeah. And it's definitely, to Scott's point, hugely influential to so many filmmakers that people today love.
And remade multiple times. You know, The Magnificent Seven was a remake of The Seven Samurai.
It's when somebody tells you, I don't like the Beatles. You hear that. I hate the Beatles. Yeah, but whoever you like is influenced by them. Maybe not directly, but indirectly. All roads lead back to the Beatles and Bob Dylan, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of modern pop music. And Seventh Samurai is a good example of that. All roads lead back to this movie in one way or the other.
Yeah, I mean, for those who haven't heard of it, and I can't imagine anyone hasn't, but it's about a group of villagers in feudal Japan that are under siege by a bunch of mercenaries that are coming in and attacking them. And to save themselves, they solicit the help of some samurais to come help defend them. So they hire these seven samurais of differing personalities. Toshiro Mifune plays probably the most colorful of the group. And they obviously come in and they stand against the... Now, that story has been done countless times Again, The Magnificent Seven was the American remake back with Steve McQueen, Charles Bronson, which they then remade with Denzel Washington.
Right.
But that story has been told again. And The Three Amigos is the same, yeah. the same story
yeah,
again and again. But it all ties back to The Seven Samurai, and it's really a great, great film.
Yes. So, okay, what number two on your list here?
Number two is maybe not one that's widely known. It's a movie that certainly made an impact on me. It's a 1988 Dutch film called The Vanishing.
Yes.
It was eventually remade with Kiefer Sutherland, Jeff Bridges.
Yes.
Nancy Travis.
I saw the remake. I liked it.
It's almost the same movie with the exception of the final act.
Right.
It's basically about a guy's traveling with his girlfriend. They go to a truck stop to, you know, get gas and food or whatever. And the girlfriend disappears.
Right.
And the guy spends the next portion of his life trying to figure out what happened to his girlfriend. She's gone. Right. He's putting up, have you seen this woman? He's going on TV talk shows. He has no idea where he is. Eventually, he's approached by a gentleman who goes, I know what happened to her. He basically says he abducted her. And the guy's like, I'm going to go to the cops. I'm going to arrest you. And the guy's like, well, fine. I'll deny everything. You have no proof.
Right.
And there's a little bit of a flashback to this a serial killer character, whatever, where you kind of see him prepping for the abduction. But it's a very haunting movie.
Yeah.
And the way it ends stays with you after you watch it. Now, when it got a time for the American remake, they're like, we can't end it like that.
Yeah.
So they had to put an action sequence, and, you know, it kind of undermined the effectiveness of the original.
Right. I remember that. I remember watching the remake, enjoying it, but then everybody at the time saying the original is so much better. I've not seen the original. I should watch the original. But
George Sluzay, I may be mispronouncing that, was the director. But it's, again, if you want to watch something that's a little unnerving. I mean, it's not gross. It's not right. It's not a gore fest by any. It's a disturbing film, but a very powerful one and it's all about obsession and things like that.
So number three
is a film that was very big during my college years. It's kind of about college memories and The Big Chill. Kasdan's The Big Chill, which was, you know, I've adored that movie ever since it came out.
Another hugely, I think, influential film.
Fantastic cast.
Yes.
You know, some of the best actors working then and today.
Yes, you still recognize the cast.
Yeah, I mean, Kevin Kline, Glenn Close, Jeff Goldblum, William Hurt, who sadly passed away about a year ago. A group of college friends reuniting because one of their college mates took his own life.
Right.
So it's about them revisiting how their lives have changed.
Who was the person who killed himself? Who was in
Kevin Costner.
Kevin Costner, right.
He actually had a bigger part and
cut
shot
the whole
films,
thing.
Shot scenes which were flashbacks. Then Lawrence Kasdan, the director, felt it was not as effective
right.
showing.
Now, are those scenes on the Criterion Collection?
No. They've never seen them. There's only a couple of shots of Kevin Costner in the movie.
Right.
At the beginning of the movie, they play.
So those scenes have never seen the light of day in any way.
Not that I'm aware of.
Right. So, okay.
But there's a couple of scenes where you see them dressing the corpse. You never see his face. You just see like a close-up of his hair.
Right.
Or his hands where they're putting a suit on him. It's a corpse.
Right.
And then eventually the last shot of the corpse, you see that he cut his wrists.
Right.
So there's scars there.
So, yeah, influential film, hugely influential soundtrack. It still sells today.
Fantastic.
I mean, that was the beginning
one of
a lot of
the movie.
Yeah, it set a kind of a new not standard, but a new approach to soundtracks for films back then. So it's a good choice.
Yeah, it's a really beautiful one. And the nice thing about the Criterion Collection is they have a reuniting Q&A of the cast from 2013.
Okay.
Which, you know, was 30 years later.
Right. Nice.
So it's nice to see them all reminiscing and telling behind the scenes stories.
Nice feature. So number four on this list.
Number four, we're going to go with Christopher Nolan's first film. So if you're into Oppenheimer or The Dark Knight, or you want to kind of see a filmmaker where he got his start, the movie Following.
Okay.
It's a relatively short film. It's only 70 minutes. It was made for $6,000, shot in black and white. Christopher Nolan's first movie.
Okay.
About a guy who just spends his days following people.
All right.
Just seeing where do they go, what do they do. And eventually he runs into this guy who's a thief. Breaks into people's houses. The thief knows he's being followed and approaches the guy and says, well, if you follow me, why don't you just come with me? And kind of gets this guy embroiled in his day-to-day activities. There's a couple twists, as you would expect from Christopher Nolan. But that's, like I said, it's not going to be something on the level of The Dark Knight or Oppenheimer. But you know, if you're interested in kind of seeing where Christopher Nolan got his start, it's a great one to watch.
All right. So number five.
Number five, I'm going to say the original Godzilla.
The
original Godzilla, Gojira, which was 1954, the original Japanese film. Criterion put out a nice edition of that one, beautifully restored. So, you know, if you like Godzilla Minus Zero and you want to go back and see where it all started, 1954's original. The Criterion edition has not only the original Japanese release, but also the kind of reworked American release, which came out 2 years later, where they got actor Raymond Burr, Ironside, Perry Mason, to come. I don't know if it was Ironside. I can't remember. It's been a while. Definitely it was Perry Mason. But he played a reporter who was kind of tracking down the Godzilla creature, and it was just kind of a way to make it viable for American audiences. But if you want to see the original Japanese version, which is more a mediation on World War II and nuclear fallout and all that stuff, it's, like I said, it is the original Godzilla film, and there's a lot of nice stuff in it. Interviews with Akira Takarada, who was the male lead in the film, and Haru Nakajima, who played Godzilla. Haru Nakajima unfortunately passed away, but he's the original suit actor in the original Godzilla.
Ah, interesting. All right, so number six on this Criterion list.
You had mentioned the love of the Beatles. How could I bring up the Criterion without bringing the release of A Hard Day's Night?
Yep.
They did a beautiful transfer. If you want to know what Beatlemania was all about when the British invasion hit, Hard Day's Night would be your way into it. From the opening guitar strum of A Hard Day's Night and seeing them being chased down the street by all the girl fans, that's it. So it's, you know, like I said, pristine transfer. It's a lot of fun to watch. All the personalities. What was so great about the Beatles at the time was not only the music, of course, but just their personalities. Their larger-than-life, fun personalities.
They were young kids.
Yeah, they were young kids
living the dream.
Time of their lives.
Yep.
So A Hard Day's Night, you know, again, it's got a killer soundtrack, as one would expect. It's a lot of fun. Richard Lester, the director, they've got some nice special features on the Criterion disc as well, including a short film that Lester made prior called the Running, Jumping, and Standing film, which that was kind of the style when the Beatles saw that. They said, oh, this would be a guy to tap
right
to do our movie.
Yeah.
So if you're into the Beatles or you want to trip down, you know, British Invasion memory lane, Hard Day's Night.
So number seven.
Number seven, Monty Python's The Life of Brian.
Okay.
I mean Monty Python, they only made five films in the course. I mean, they had the TV series The Flying Circus, and they only made five films, one of which was a live concert film, although technically I could say six films, because they did do another DVD release, which I have, of the a reuniting concert that they did. But this was, I believe, their third movie following And Now for Something Completely Different, which was really just a compilation of skits from the TV show, The Holy Grail, which is my favorite of their films. But then you get to 1979's Life of Brian. And like I said, it's basically, a lot of people misconstrue it and they go, oh, they're making fun of the story of Jesus Christ. And it's really not about Jesus Christ. It's about this character named Brian, who is at times mistaken for Jesus Christ.
Right.
But it's very funny. You know, and all the parts with Jesus in the movie are pretty straightforward. They don't really deviate from it. But, you know, their idea is like, well, if Jesus was giving a Sermon on the Mount, what if there was a guy way in the back who couldn't hear what he was saying? So there's a whole scene of that. And the humor isn't making fun of Jesus. It's making fun of this idiot who's all the way in the back and can't hear what he's saying. So it's, like I said, if you like Monty Python, Life of Brian is, I think, critically seen as their best film. And the nice thing about the Criterion is they have a few different commentary tracks with different members of the Monty Python group, Eric Idle, John Cleese. So that's a good visit if you want a nice dose of British
all right
humor.
What's next?
Next we got number eight, the original Night of the Living Dead. Now, there have been multiple physical releases of Night of the Living Dead for years. It's in the public domain. I don't think you could walk into a store without seeing some video label putting out Night of the Living Dead. But the transfers are all garbage. Secondhand transfers from VHSs, someone put on a disc and released it as a DVD. Finally, somebody put out a really nice version of Night of the Living Dead. 1968, George Romero, his first film. I mean, if you like The Walking Dead, World War Z, Fear the Walking Dead, this is where it all started.
Right.
This was the first zombie movie where it was basically the dead coming to life and eating the living.
Right.
You know, as gruesome as that sounds. Zombies before that were kind of like White Zombie with Bela Lugosi. It was more like voodoo and tied into religion, and it was different. This was the first where someone's crawling out of a grave and is coming to get you.
Right.
You know, and they're walking really, really slow.
Yeah. No, it's a good, again, like the transfers, like you said, are pretty terrible. Usually Criterion did a beautiful transfer. That's a great pick. So number nine.
I've got Thief, Michael Mann's first film. So if you like films like The Insider or The Last of the Mohicans, Heat with Robert De Niro, Thief was his first film.
Michael Mann is like a really, I think, underrated director.
Oh, definitely, definitely.
Nobody talks about Michael Mann, and everything he makes is pretty good.
Yeah, it's about basically like a thief played by James Caan, and he's hired on different jobs, usually bank heists, going through the vault, and he's great at what he does, and he gets hired by kind of an underworld character to do a job, and he kind of gets roped in with this guy who is an evil man and betrays him in a way. But it's really good. Great performance by James Caan. The Criterion does do the director's cut and the theatrical cut, so you can watch either. It's got commentary tracks. It's got a commentary with Michael Mann and James Caan together talking about the making of the film. So that's really really great. Sidetrack before I get to my final pick is one of my favorite films of all time is Danny Boyle's Trainspotting, which is being released next week, January 30th, I think is the Tuesday, on Criterion. They're doing a 4K transfer with special features and documentaries.
And let me guess.
I've got it pre-ordered.
You're going to be buying it. It's going to go on the shelf.
I've got that poster hanging in my office, and I will be buying that disc next week. So
all right. That's so again, we're not, again,
these
point
in
of
any order.
Right. Point of the show is to rank stuff. It's pop ranks, to give it away in the title of the podcast. But this one, it's impossible, and I asked Scott just to come up with 10 that he likes.
And
so
I know people are going to listen and say, well, you left out the films of—
Well, that's what we wanted. We want to hear from everybody.
Jean-Luc Godard and Sergei Eisenstein. And, you know,
that's what we want to hear.
That's not what this is about.
But we want to hear that. Hear from you and tell us your favorites. So number one here on your list, and I don't know if this would be your favorite. Maybe it would be. Coincidentally, you do love this one, and I love this Criterion.
I love this movie, and this might actually be my favorite Criterion release. So I did save it for last.
Right.
It's been re-released in other versions by other companies, but my favorite, this is Spinal Tap.
Right.
Director Rob Reiner's, who people previously knew as Meathead on All in the Family. This was his first directorial effort, and it's a mockumentary about a rock band called Spinal Tap.
Right.
Then they just kind of interview these guys who were on tour. Nigel St. Hubbins, I can't remember the names. But the three guys, and it just follows them along. And if you like rock and roll documentaries or you're into music, it's just a fun watch.
It's not to be taken seriously. Stone cold classic. It's been imitated a thousand times since. It's a fantastic movie, and the Criterion is particularly great. You love it because
like I said, three actors, Michael McKean, who a lot of people know from Better Call Saul, Harry Shearer, and Christopher Guest, who's since gone on to become a very famous director of other mockumentaries across multiple titles. Best in Show, it being a great example. They're the band. They're playing these fictional characters, but the movie is treating them like they're a real band.
Right.
And the music's actually not that bad. They've gone on tour, those actors, as the
characters. Yes, they have.
The Criterion Edition, at least when it came out, and you can still get it, they do a commentary as the band, in character as the band. So you're watching a mockumentary about a fictional band, listening to a commentary track by the actors in character as this fictional band commenting on the documentary that was made about them.
Right.
As bizarre as that sounds, it's a lot of fun.
No, it sounds great. Again, that's just a list of 10 Criterion titles that Scott recommends you picking up and checking out. We'd love to hear in the comments section some titles. I mean, we obviously couldn't get them all. There's hundreds of them.
Oh, yeah.
And there's probably some Scott might not even own. So you can tell him.
Lots.
Yeah. I'll tell him some of your personal favorites. And yeah, again, physical media is definitely going the way of the dinosaur, but Criterion is doing great work. In fact, we will link at the bottom here to all of these titles that Scott mentioned, including Trainspotting. We'll give you some links where you could go and maybe pick them up yourself again.
Yeah, and one side note on that, if you want to check out the Criterion Collection, I mean, you can go to their website, obviously, and purchase things, but Barnes & Noble is still a pretty good seller of physical media. And they actually have a Criterion section.
They do. They have an entire section of Criterion.
And periodically, they'll have like 50% off sales. So if there's a film you're interested in that you stumble across on the website or through our links that you want to go and purchase, like I said, keep your eyes open periodically. Barnes & Noble will have a 50% off sale.
Yeah. So that's it for this episode of Pop Ranks. We'll be back soon. And until next time.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Pop Ranks, an IDC production. Produced and hosted by Scott Carroll and Eric Wickstrom. Audio engineer, Paul Levin. Executive producer, Marcy Gilbert. Remember to like and subscribe.